claims that Trump intended to act with hostility toward Muslims. Trump's own statements were such evidence, and the first version of the executive order contained an explicit exemption that, in practice, would favor Christians. But it was not entirely clear that the evidence showed the kind of hostility that would impugn the revised version of the executive order. It is also not entirely clear how the principle of religious neutrality applies to non-citizens who are outside the country, and whether a claim based on that principle could be raised by the individuals and institutions inside the U.S. who brought the suit. The courts that said the administration did not show a real risk of harm to the interests of the United States also had a point. While courts would ordinarily be very deferential to a presidential action dealing with national security and immigration, especially when that action was based on a broadly worded statute, there are still some limits to what even a president can do, even in those circumstances. The statute would not permit a presidential action that was completely arbitrary. The first version of the executive order seemed very ill-considered. It was so sloppily drafted that it was not even clear whether it applied to green card holders, non-citizens who have a right to be in the United States, but who might have been temporarily outside the country when the order was issued. The first version of the order was not reviewed by some of the government agencies that should have been involved in the process. The evidence that the restriction was needed was thin or non-existent. The second version of the executive order was more carefully done, but there was reason to think that the problems were just papered over, not seriously addressed. On the other hand, in an ordinary case, courts would not look too deeply into the internal workings of the executive branch. If the order was unclear or otherwise flawed, they might just correct the flaws, or even overlook them, rather than using them as a basis to declare the order invalid. And ordinarily, not much evidence would be needed to support an executive order of this kind. So, while there was a basis for striking down the orders, some solid legal arguments were also made in support of them. So were the decisions correct? If there was a significant risk that the administration's actions reflected a systematic undermining of liberal democratic values, then the courts were right to rule in a way that limited the president's power. That is how courts should respond to a slow-motion emergency. The evidence that there was such an emergency could come from both the executive order litigation itself and the larger context of the administration's actions. The internal executive branch processes of information gathering and critical analysis are not always visible, but they are crucial ways in which an ill-considered or malign political agenda can be held in check. When those processes are systematically lacking or are subverted, courts are entitled to be wary. The executive orders, in the context of statements made by the president in particular, seemed to be part of an effort to stigmatize a vulnerable religious minority. That evidence of a slow-motion emergency combined with other indications of illiberal and undemocratic impulses, a lack of transparency and accountability, the vilification of political opponents, hostility to courts and other institutional checks, insensitivity to the risks of corruption and nepotism. The courts may have had reason to think there was the kind of threat to democratic institutions that justified them in choosing, among the legally plausible conclusions, the one that limited executive power, irrespective of whether that would otherwise have been the better view of the law. 2. It's hardly surprising that, quite apart from what the law might formally say, courts will sometimes push back against what they see as overreaching by the president. But this is not just an empirical reality, and it is not something that has to be treated as extra-legal, as a kind of judicial civil disobedience. Within limits, it is an example of how the law develops. Foundational principles, like the principle that courts should defer to the president's decisions about matters having to do with national security, should not be discarded or ignored. But sometimes they should be qualified, modified, or adapted to deal with exceptional circumstances. It goes without saying that this is a fraught process. Part of the point of having principles is to resist the temptation to do something that seems expedient in the moment, but is wrong. In the more familiar kinds of emergencies, like a war or a terror attack, the adaptation of fundamental principles can lead to gross abuses of human rights. The internment of Americans of Japanese descent during World War II is the most notorious example, but there are others. When the apparent emergency is a descent into authoritarianism, the analogous risk is that the court's response will unnecessarily, and maybe dangerously, limit the government's power to serve the national interest. But we can't avoid this problem by just insisting on the immutability of certain principles. Courts and others in positions of power will, as a matter of fact, respond to what they see as exceptional circumstances. No amount of insisting on the inviolability of foundational principles will prevent that. The challenge is to try to identify when the courts should engage in this kind of adaptation and how they might do it so as to minimize the risks of abuses. In U.S. constitutional law, the civil rights era of the mid-20th century gives us some examples of this process. Adapting legal principles in ways that are plausible, but certainly questionable in response to exceptionally threatening circumstances. Discussions about whether it could happen in the United States sometimes overlook that it did happen in the United States. From roughly the late 19th to the mid-20th century, parts of the United States were ruled by an undemocratic, illiberal, racist regime. African Americans were denied the right to vote and were violently repressed both by the government and by private individuals acting with the tacit approval of the government. When the courts began to respond to that regime, established legal rules seemed to be a barrier. For example, it is a long-standing principle supported by the text of the Constitution that, with few exceptions, constitutional rights are rights against the government only, not against private individuals. Civil rights laws enacted by the federal government in the 1960s allowed people to enforce comparable rights, rights against discrimination in housing, employment, and places like restaurants and hotels, for example, against private individuals. But before then, in states that did not have those laws, the only weapon against a racist regime was the Constitution. And it, among other limitations, did not reach private conduct. And private conduct, or ostensibly private conduct tacitly supported by the state, was one of the principal weapons that regime used. The courts responded in the ways I have suggested are appropriate for dealing with a threat to democracy. They stretched the law, not beyond the limits of plausibility, but in ways that could be criticized, and were criticized in good faith, by some analysts as legally incorrect. One of the most famous examples, the case of Shelley versus Kramer, dealt with the racially restrictive housing covenant, a provision in a deed that obligated the buyer of a house not to sell it to a non-white person. These covenants were a way of making sure that blacks could not move into the same neighborhoods as whites. They were common. So the effect was essentially the same as a law that forbade blacks from buying homes in white areas. But the covenants were just agreements among private buyers and sellers. And because the Constitution is limited to actions by the government, they seem to be beyond the reach of constitutional law. In Shelley, the Supreme Court got around that limit by saying that racially restrictive covenants could not be enforced in court. The theory was that the courts are part of the government to which the Constitution applies. The effect was that a homeowner who was supposedly bound by a racially restrictive covenant could sell the property to a black person with impunity. So even private efforts to maintain all white communities were defeated. The decision in Shelley was not flagrantly outside the bounds of legal respectability. The courts are, after all, part of the government. But to this day, no one is quite sure how to justify it. Courts routinely enforce all kinds of contracts. To say that the government is complicit in discrimination whenever the courts enforce a contract motivated by private prejudice seems to collapse the Constitution's distinction between government and private action. Or, in the terms of a familiar law school hypothetical example, If the police are called to eject an uninvited guest from a private home, do they first have to check to see if the guest was uninvited because of race, sex, religion, or sexual orientation? On the theory that otherwise they will be engaging in discrimination, just like the courts that enforce the discriminatory housing covenant. Another example from the same period dealt with the lengths to which politicians went to keep blacks from voting. Elections themselves, of course, are run by the government, and the 15th Amendment explicitly forbids racial discrimination by states in voting. But the states that practiced racial apartheid were, like many autocracies, one-party states. For the most part, only Democrats were ever elected to state or local office. So the authorities could effectively disenfranchise African Americans by keeping them from voting in the Democratic Party primaries that selected the Democratic Party nominee. But the courts held that excluding African Americans from the primaries was unconstitutional, because the party primaries used state election facilities, and the state placed the winners of the primaries on the election ballot. Democrats in Texas tried a different tactic to evade the Constitution. They set up something called the Jaybird Club. It was a private organization, but a private organization whose members were all the white members of the Democratic Party in Texas. The Jaybird Club had elections to decide which candidate to support in the Democratic Party primary, and that candidate routinely won the primary and the election. In Terry versus Adams, the Supreme Court ruled that this arrangement was unconstitutional. The justices could not agree on a rationale among themselves, and, as is true of Shelley, there is even today no generally agreed-upon justification for the decision. The Constitution does not prevent private clubs from discriminating. It obviously does not prevent private clubs from voting on which candidates to support in an election. And it does not forbid people from voting for their club's choice. Both Shelley and Terry were criticized at the time as legally unsound. Some of the critics were people whose moral opposition to racist practices was unquestioned. Those decisions, the critics said, were unprincipled. They were prompted by an admirable opposition to racism, but could not be reconciled with established constitutional law. The same kind of criticism was, in fact, leveled against Brown versus Board of Education, the now iconic decision declaring state-supported segregation unconstitutional. But today, few people would say that Shelley or Terry, or certainly Brown, was wrong. They were important steps in helping to abolish a racist regime. The courts that decided these cases were responding to an ongoing assault on liberal democratic values. The people waging that assault took advantage of the established legal principle that the Constitution applies only to government action by interweaving public and private action in a way designed to subvert constitutional norms. The Supreme Court did not jettison the principle. Perhaps the evil it was fighting was great enough that it would have been justified in doing so. But the court also was not deterred by the entirely mainstream objections that its decisions were inconsistent with existing law. Instead, the court tried to stay within the bounds of plausible legality by stretching the definition of unconstitutional government action to cover the enforcement of racial covenants and the Jaybird Club. That is a model for how a court might respond to threats to liberal democracy more generally. 3. The Civil Rights era was an extraordinary period, and you have to be careful in drawing lessons from it. Still, we may be living through an extraordinary period now, and there are lessons to be drawn from the Civil Rights era cases. The first is that courts have to decide how bad the problem is, how severe the threat to democratic institutions. Racial apartheid was more than a threat. It was an actually existing authoritarian system within the United States. That justified the court's extraordinary actions. Something is an emergency only if there is a risk of serious damage to democratic institutions. The second lesson, which may be less obvious, is that the courts have to assess how much harm they might cause when they stretch legal principles to address the threat. When the response to an emergency might allow human rights to be violated on a large scale, that is, of course, a reason not to choose that response. when the response might keep government authorities from protecting national security or otherwise dealing with a serious problem, that is also a reason to hesitate. In the civil rights cases, the possible harm was to allow the federal government, rather than the states, to determine what kinds of private actions would be lawful. It is fair to count that as a harm, but it is not on the same scale as ratifying the internment of people of Japanese ancestry. In the Trump executive order cases, the administration had acted in ways that suggested it was not really responding to a national security threat. So the courts had reason to think the potential harm from their intervention was not so great. A related point, implicit in the idea that the courts are adapting rather than ignoring or revising the law, is that courts are most justified in taking the kinds of actions I have described when the government seems to be exploiting loopholes, acting in ways that are arguably consistent with the letter of the law, but inconsistent with its purposes. In the Jaberg case, it was obvious that the white Democratic Party was doing exactly that. The core of the challenge to the Trump executive order is that it, too, was using claims about national security as a pretext. Pretextual action by the government is not always wrong. Sometimes a government has to deal with an unanticipated problem by using legal tools that were designed for a different purpose. But courts are at least justified in viewing pretextual action suspiciously, and preventing such action is less likely to damage the government's legitimate interests. The third lesson is that when courts respond to emergencies by adapting the law, they can be, and should be, tentative and experimental. Because they stay within the framework of the law, they, or future judges, can decide whether the law should continue to evolve in the same direction or should retreat. If the civil rights era cases had allowed the federal government to interfere with truly private relationships that should have been sacrosanct, those cases could have been limited or rolled back. By demanding that the Trump administration show that its executive order really did have a basis in national security concerns, and that it was not an expression of animosity toward Muslims, the courts left open the option of backing off if those showings could be made. All of this seems to suggest that the courts are themselves unmoved by the kinds of overreactions and biases they are supposedly correcting, that courts will be able to identify slow-motion emergencies and react accordingly. Of course, that is very unrealistic. There are obvious and important risks in saying that courts can shape the law in response to what they think are slow-motion emergencies. In fact, the risks have been realized. Three examples come to mind. First, many opponents of President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal thought they were facing a threat of authoritarianism. They did not think the threat was developing in slow motion. They thought it was imminent. The Supreme Court, to some degree, responded in the way I have suggested, not by stepping wholly outside the law, but by pushing the law in a direction that would limit the president and, more generally, the federal government. The court held that the president's power to dismiss executive branch officials could be narrowed by Congress, and it struck down some of the laws that were, at least initially, centerpieces of the president's program on the ground that they exceeded the federal government's constitutional powers. Many of those decisions, although not all, have since been repudiated by the court. The second example is Bush versus Gore, the case that effectively decided the presidential election of 2000. The decision was, in my view, legally indefensible. The court did not just extend the law to its limits, but instead went well beyond them. But it seems reasonably clear that the court thought it was confronted with an emergency, either electoral chaos, because there might be no clear decision about who was president, or what some of the justices apparently saw as a partisan coup by state court judges, who, had the Supreme Court not intervened, would have effectively controlled the crucial electoral votes. The third example was the Supreme Court's treatment of the Affordable Care Act in NFIB versus Sebelius. The Affordable Care Act, and particularly the individual mandate, a provision that requires everyone to have health insurance, were attacked as a gross infringement on liberty. The attacks were unwarranted. The central features of the ACA were supported by a bipartisan consensus until the act became identified with President Obama. But some members of the Supreme Court reacted as if they were confronted with a slow-motion emergency. The court ruled, by a 5-4 vote, that Congress did not have the power to enact the individual mandate under the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution, the clause that is the basis of much federal regulation of the economy. The court did say the individual mandate could be justified on a different basis, but four justices rejected both justifications. The ACA also required states to extend Medicaid to a new class of recipients as a condition of continued funding for existing Medicaid programs. The court held that the requirement unconstitutionally coerced the states, so states could refuse to expand Medicaid without further cost. Both of these rulings were, at the very least, questionable under existing law. In each of these cases, in my view, the Supreme Court's action was unwarranted. There was no risk of incipient authoritarianism or electoral chaos, but the lesson is not, I think, that the kind of response to a perceived emergency I am defending, for the courts to adapt the law in a direction that mitigates the problem, should be condemned. The lesson is rather that the courts will engage in this kind of action when they think it is warranted. We are better off acknowledging that this is part of our system. Courts will modify and shape principles in new ways in response to particular circumstances, and they will do so especially aggressively in response to what they see as an emergency, sudden, or slow motion. Rather than saying this kind of behavior by the courts is wrong, we should instead say that judges ought to be self-consciously aware that they are doing it, that they are pushing the limits of existing principles in response to extraordinary circumstances, and that they should be prepared to justify their actions, at least to themselves and their colleagues. Whether they have to explain everything in their published opinions is another matter. Opinions are public documents that serve other purposes besides revealing the author's thought processes. They should be prepared, at least introspectively, to say what the extraordinary circumstances are, why they think those circumstances exist, why the response still observes the outer limits of what is legally permissible, and why it is worth incurring the risks that come with reshaping established principles to push those limits. If we instead try to maintain the notion that it is improper for judges to adapt the law to deal with exceptional circumstances, judges, in response, will convince themselves they are not pushing the limits of the law when they are in fact doing so. If we acknowledge that this is a legitimate thing for judges to do, it will also encourage them to approach the response to emergencies, sudden or slow motion, in an experimental vein, as I suggested, to be prepared to back off or go further when they see how matters play out. There is one final danger we can avoid if we recognize that judges not only do, but properly can respond in the ways I have described. Some judges, we know, will respond this way in any event. They are likely to be judges who are most ideologically motivated, or who have the most exalted view of their role. Those judges should not have the field to themselves. It will be better if judges who are more restrained by temperament or self-conception understand that they can responsibly respond to emergencies, including slow-motion emergencies, by a carefully thought-through decision to adapt the law to the extraordinary circumstances they are confronting. How Democracies Perish. Stephen Holmes. They say America first, but they mean America next. Woody Guthrie. The populist venom being directed these days at politically vulnerable universities speaks against pejorative resort to the word academic. Yet the currently beleaguered state of liberal democracy is definitely not an academic subject, or at least not only an academic subject. It is also an existential one, involving some of the most dismaying and unnerving trends of our time, with potentially ominous consequences for our personal and collective lives. During the Cold War, many Western thinkers were tormented by the thought that liberal democratic societies could succumb to totalitarian temptation. Jean-François Revel's 1980s best-selling How Democracies Perish was typical of the genre. Then, in the hinge year of 1989, these dark clouds dissipated virtually overnight. From staggering helplessly at death's door, it seemed, Western-style democracy not only recovered its health, but became joyously triumphant, and even, according to one celebrated pundit, ideologically uncontestable. But the rebound was less enduring than had been hoped. After the Iraq War, the financial crisis of 2008, the derailing of the Arab Spring, economic dynamism in China, where pro-democracy protesters are routinely charged with subversion, electoral victories of xenophobic authoritarians in East Central Europe, increasing support for anti-immigrant and anti-EU movements in Western Europe, the senseless Brexit referendum, the fraying of the Atlantic Alliance, and the upset political victory of the 45th President of the United States, the prospects for liberal democracy are once again in doubt. The unthinkable is not yet probable, but neither can it be casually ruled out. Wherever we are headed, we need to look seriously again at the conditions under which democratic government, hollowed out from within, might gradually sicken and suddenly die. To broach the manifold infirmities and potential transience of democratic self-government, I begin with a revealing anecdote and a derivative generalization. During an electoral campaign in Brazil, Albert Hirschman once cited a billboard that announced, "We are tired of austerity. We want promises." The facetiousness of the slogan should not distract from its far-reaching implications. In reality, much of modern politics is about promising, disappointing, and managing the negative consequences of bitter disappointments. All governments promise and disappoint. One of the signal virtues of liberal democracy is its uncommon facility at mitigating the fallout of political discontent. Mitigation means, most importantly, preventing civic frustrations in the face of unpopular policies and deteriorating conditions from engendering violent confrontations between lethally armed and ideologically polarized citizens, or between infuriated citizens and the forces of public order. This is a crucial task, because blood-splattered streets can be a breeding ground for that justly feared authoritarian temptation, precipitating the ruinous breakdown of democracy. A multi-party representative system where challengers have a reasonable chance of removing and replacing incumbents may or may not align the preferences of politicians with the preferences of voters. It may or may not produce good governance and economic prosperity, and it may or may not be at peace with its neighbors. But periodic elections in a pluralistic democracy ideally fulfill another function that they often perform quite well, and that helps account for much of democracy's indisputable political appeal. They ensure domestic tranquility, despite the frequency of buyer's remorse, or the all-too-common disappointment of citizens in the performance of their own popularly elected rulers. The very possibility of l'alternance, the expectation that a shadow government or rival governing team has a good chance of ousting the incumbents in an upcoming election, subsidizes patience with the deficiencies of the current administration. The mere possibility that the outs may replace the ins can dispel the nightmare of having to stare into the faces of an unchanging leadership, tiresomely addressing citizens with dubious honesty for the indeterminate future. This is true even if, as is likely, the new incumbents turn out, after their proverbial honeymoon, to be just as disappointing as their predecessors. Well-organized democracies, in other words, systematically channel public disgruntlement inside the system, rather than allowing it to fester unaddressed and eventually erupt onto the public squares, where minor clashes can accidentally escalate into uncontrollable violence. One of the principal functions of representative government, according to Max Weber, is to break the irregular rule of the street. Rather than burning dumpsters at intersections, discontented citizens can be lured into organizing for the next elections, expending the fuel of political grievance and letdown on party political competition, so long as the system is not blatantly rigged against them and they have a reasonable chance of prevailing in the future. Political elites presumably found this system acceptable for analogous reasons. In early monarchies, when one political dynasty replaced another, the winners often felt compelled to murder all significant members of the ousted family grouping. Multi-party democracy, whatever its other failings, is not so cruel to electoral losers in the struggle for power. However much they disagree ideologically, competing political factions today normally concur on the mutual benefits of soft landing sites for the electorally defeated. In a stable liberal democracy, losers will not be stripped of their wealth and imprisoned together with their families. The last thing a candidate who respected liberal democratic norms would say about his partisan opponent, in other words, is lock her up. Incumbents as well as challengers willingly submit themselves to electoral competitions that they may conceivably lose for another reason too. Holding office pro tempore is more appealing than holding office for life, because the former is less likely than the latter to excite impatient rivals into committing desperate acts. After all, life tenure implies that the only way to remove an incumbent from office is to remove him or her from life. Holding out to one's restless competitors the possibility of a peaceful transfer of power in the not-too-distant future is an obviously attractive strategy for reducing enticements to political assassination. These safety valve rationales for democratic competition are plausible and important. They nevertheless remain excessively negative, placing sole focus on the avoidance of violence. They therefore wrongly neglect the positive effects of the bias for hope built into a political system where rival governing teams alternate in power. Even if such a system does not guarantee good governance or allow citizens to control politicians, it can nevertheless diffuse a sense of buoyant expectancy or social energy throughout the community, vividly illustrating the possibility of a fresh start and exciting a creative fertility and spirit of innovation in science, art, industry, and other spheres of activity in civil society, an outpouring of extra-political elan very unlikely to develop under a dead-hand government that cannot be challenged or peacefully changed. But let us stick for the moment with the first, and for our purposes more essential point, that liberal democracy is a time-tested system for managing political disappointment. This perspective on how democracy works contains an implicit warning about the gravity and urgency of our current predicament. A properly functioning democracy helps diminish the level of political violence in a society by funneling discontent into legal channels, rather than letting it rage unaddressed on the outside, where it can incubate extra-parliamentary attacks on the constitutional order. Our central problem today is the seemingly global discontent with liberal democracy itself. Many polls suggest that young people are especially likely to feel disenchanted or simply uninterested in electoral competition. In Italy, where popularly elected leaders seem paralyzed in the face of economic stagnation and unstanched migrant flows from the failed state of Libya, one shocking poll reports that 83% of voters between the ages of 18 and 29 prefer a strong leader to a democracy. However methodologically sound, admittedly, such surveys provide scant evidence that elections are about to be canceled in any advanced Western democracy, much less that democracy in general is on the cusp of dying to thunderous applause, to cite the renowned senator Padme Amidala. On the other hand, a general softening of public and elite commitment to the democratic legitimacy formula can, under especially stressful circumstances, prove disastrous. In a severe crisis, disenchantment with democracy can undermine the willingness of ordinary citizens and political elites to fight tenaciously for the survival of their embattled political system. Democracy depends for its endurance not on fair-weather Democrats, but on loyalty in adversity. Those who have the capacity to defend a besieged democracy must also have the incentive and the disposition to do so. True, the numerous survey results suggesting a diminishing appreciation for democracy across social classes in the West do not necessarily imply that democracy is dying, but optimism is no more justified than pessimism in this regard. Human beings have a roughly equal tendency to overestimate and to underestimate threats. As a result, the unjustified complacency echoed in best-case scenarios poses just as great a danger to the survival of crisis-stricken liberal democracies as the unjustified hysteria expressed in worst-case scenarios. The Soviet Union collapsed because, among other reasons, those in a position to fight for its survival had ceased to believe that it was worth saving. Could the same fate be awaiting the liberal democratic West? Social scientists can track changes in public attitudes with greater or lesser accuracy. But social science can be defined as history with the events left out. Democracies perish when they do because of events. Attitudinal changes are consequential or insignificant depending on cascades of unforeseen occurrences with which citizens and their rulers are forced to contend. For example, a relentless series of high-level political assassinations can create an atmosphere of panic and instability that will put intolerable pressure on any democracy that enjoys only anemic legitimacy in the eyes of organized interests and public officials. A 9/11-style mass casualty terrorist attack on, say, Washington, D.C., would have similar consequences. And as mentioned, when street-level violence persists over time, lukewarm Democrats will be tempted to throw themselves into the arms of an authoritarian demagogue who promises to secure public order. Democracy's survival, therefore, depends essentially on the readiness of the main social forces to combat populist demagoguery and other corrosive trends to maintain the norms, procedures, and values of democracy. The danger we face is great or small, depending on the strength or weakness of our psychological and organizational defenses against it. If allegiance to democracy becomes sufficiently uncertain, then, in a dizzying crisis, all bets are off. The failure of one of America's two great political parties to resist the rise of a candidate who announced in advance his refusal to accept the electoral victory of his opponent, that is, who publicly repudiated the basic norm of democracy, illustrates why we need to take seriously the multiple reasons for a general atrophy of public support for democratic government. But to repeat, an attitudinal shift is not necessarily dangerous in itself. It is a serious problem only if an unspoken contempt for democracy, first, induces a political party's leadership and voters to support a candidate for the presidency who is manifestly indifferent to the constitutional order. And second, if it presages an unwillingness by others to defend our highly complex system of government when push comes to shove. Some of the most commonly discussed reasons for disappointment with democracy are country-specific. In the United States, for example, critics of the current system focus on the rivers of money corrupting the electoral process, permitting capture of the legislative process by corporate donors, as well as on the gerrymandering that has reduced turnout by making the vast majority of House of Representatives races non-competitive. These difficulties and dysfunctions are not the principal reasons for democratic discontent elsewhere in the world, however. By contrast, the popularization abroad of American-style primaries that allow the most polarized swaths of the electorate to select the candidates who will face each other in the general election is a more widely shared pathology. The same can be said about the tendency for voters in the television age to select candidates whose skills at campaigning are prodigious, but whose talents for governing are modest. For the sake of generality and to draw some illuminating parallels from abroad to the American case, I will be focusing in this chapter on such shared developments. I will look sequentially at a miscellany of factors that have cumulatively undermined public and elite confidence in the genius of democratic politics across many advanced democracies, including the United States. First, one currently salient cause for widespread doubt about democracy is illustrated by the Brexit referendum. And once again, the election of Donald Trump. If a decisive vote is held 2 months earlier or later, the outcome can be completely different. This raises the question, what exactly do electoral tallies measure? Snapshot elections and referenda presumably register the preferences of the voters who go to the polls on a specific date. But the preferences of a majority of the motivated electorate are often highly volatile and unstable. In majoritarian referenda and the American Electoral College, moreover, the lex majoris partis creates a situation where a slight favorite for an evanescent moment can become the winner who takes all. As Joseph Schumpeter remarked, you cannot fool all of the people all of the time, but you can fool enough of the people for long enough to do irreversible damage. On an individual level, potentially self-destructive decisions are sometimes structured to include waiting periods as a way to sidestep the conclusiveness of momentary whims. Two-round voting, by informing the electorate about how other voters are likely to vote in the decisive election, roughly simulates a cooling-off period at the collective level. But Brexit-style referenda and American presidential elections benefit from no such bridle on capricious decision-making on the basis of ephemeral predilections. Supermajority requirements would have an analogously steadying effect, but are incompatible with the salience of 50% plus as the most easily agreed-upon measure of community will. This vulnerability of liberal democracy to the volatility of public preferences makes its citizens hostages to fortune, a condition highly unlikely to engender die-hard loyalty to the system. It was much easier for the author of this chapter, for example, to express unqualified adherence to American democracy before American democracy injudiciously raised the current incumbent to the White House. Second, democracy creates a strong incentive for rival parties to engage in competitive overpromising. When promises that awaken excessive and unrealistic expectations go unfulfilled, as is likely, the dashed hopes can fuel a degree of indignation too deep to be assuaged democratically. Today, almost all candidates promise that, if elected, they will create jobs. Under conditions of jobless growth, unfortunately, this turns out to be a promissory note that cannot be cashed. In any single electoral cycle, such broken promises will alienate the electorate only from the party or coalition that failed to deliver on its pledges, triggering a shift of swing voters to the rival party or coalition. But the alternation in power of rival governing teams will cease to sustain the allegiance of the electorate to the democratic order if, over a series of elections, none of the parties competing for power end up creating the jobs or performing the other economic miracles they solemnly pledged to effect. This brings us to our third factor. Although holding out the promise that the next election will unhorse the current crop of rascals and bring into office a more effective governing team, democracy is not always sufficient on its own to introduce a bias for hope into society. Politically generated energy and optimism can be stifled if underlying economic trends baffle the expectation that improvement across generations is to be expected. In 1970, it turns out less than 10% of Americans were earning less than their parents at a similar age. By 2010, 50% were earning less. The perception that each generation would be better off than their parents has arguably been at the heart of Western civilization for the past 150 years or more. It is no longer believable or believed. The expectation that living standards will worsen over time is an immensely consequential change in the social underpinnings of political life. It strikes at the heart of the politically stabilizing function of democracy as detailed above. The realistic prospect of upward social mobility for one's children may have provided an essential psychological support, at least since World War II, for the hope-galvanizing effect of multi-party democratic competition. If so, an essential economic underpinning of optimistic political engagement has now been ripped away. As a result, angry distrust of all major social institutions, including democratically elected governments, has soared. Is this a mere coincidence? it seems more plausible to assume that democracy was previously able to process public frustrations inside the system, thanks at least in part to being buoyed up by historically specific and unusually encouraging economic conditions. Fourth, popular and elite allegiance to liberal democratic values and procedures has been curtailed by the amnesia that inevitably accompanies the passage of time. The end of history is an exotic myth, but the fading of historical memory is an everyday reality. According to Tony Jutt, an important factor explaining the Reagan-Thatcher attack on transfer payments was memory loss at the collective level. Only a public that had largely forgotten the harrowing experience of the Great Depression could lend such cheerful support to the weakening of the welfare state. An implication of this claim is that the concrete, lived experiences of a generational cohort exert a greater influence on shared beliefs about the limits of acceptable behavior than abstract norms of justice. The same lesson applies to the crisis of liberal democracy. Only historical amnesia can explain the cavalier resuscitation of fascist-era slogans such as America First and Rootless Cosmopolitan. The abominations of Nazism evidently lie too far in the past to reinforce shaken confidence in liberal democracy by reminding people of the dark sides of authoritarian and xenophobic alternatives. Fifth, the Cold War between the liberal democratic West and the illiberal and non-democratic USSR is also fading from memory. It has in any case been replaced as the central obsession of U.S. national security policy by the War on Terror. This swivel of the canon implies a downgrading of liberal democratic procedures and norms. Rather than deploring the way communist societies deprived dissidents of their rights, democratic politicians now rally public support by parading their willingness to deprive terrorist suspects of their rights. Brazen violations of due process apparently communicate the tough guy message that there is nothing we will not do, a wild promise apparently reassuring to a spooked electorate with little capacity to gauge the real level of the risk they face. Moreover, the war on terror has been accompanied by a concomitant shrinkage of social privacy and expansion of government secrecy. This displacement of the privacy-secrecy boundary means that the government is increasingly spying on its citizens, while the citizens are increasingly unable to examine and evaluate the government's actions. An opaque state presiding over a transparent society is difficult to reconcile with the idea that government works for the people. By swelling the budgets and influence of a largely unaccountable deep state operating on the dark side, where monitoring is weak and sporadic. In other words, the war on terror is adding to public doubts about the virtues, not to mention the capacities, of electoral democracy. This brings us back to a sixth factor. Media pluralism is an essential condition of liberal democracy. Citizens cannot rely solely on their government to provide them with the information they need to decide if their elected officials are acting intelligently and in the public interest. This is why authoritarian rulers who nevertheless feel obliged to hold and rig elections invariably shut down independent media and monopolize the television broadcasts on which the majority of voters rely for political news. But the extraordinary proliferation of media platforms today has produced a distorted caricature of media pluralism, fragmenting political space into mutually sealed-off ideological fortresses between which no serious communication is possible. In the 2016 presidential contest, moreover, the major American news outlets, profiting from public fascination with Trump's buffoonery, functioned less as a check on power than as a conveyor and magnifier of slander, disinformation, conspiracy theories, and politically calculated lies, again weakening public confidence in an essential pillar of democracy. As a final expression of post-truth populism, the current inhabitant of the White House has apparently decided that transferring power to the people means waging war on the First Amendment, which, as he sees it, is unfairly protecting the people's greatest enemy, the independent press. Seventh, reliable polls report that a large majority of European voters distrust their elected parliaments and governments. One reason, is that after the electorate votes, markets vote, or banks vote, or Brussels votes. The second series of votes are the ones that count. Decision-making by central bankers and EU technocrats, however rational economically, ignores the primacy of vanity over self-interest in human motivation. It underestimates the citizens' need to be consulted about alternatives rather than passively receiving the best policies crafted in their interests behind their backs. The Brazilian electoral slogan, "We are tired of austerity," meant in part that voters were tired of being told by technocratic experts that austerity is the only option. In fact, the opportunity to present genuine policy alternatives in a respected public forum makes it more likely that citizens will eventually go along with decisions they do not much like. Technocratic policymakers, however competent, ignore at their peril this proven democratic method for mobilizing public consent. Similarly, the puppet masters of global finance, who are often portrayed as initiating the economic policies justified in the jargon of technocrats, cannot be voted out of office. Their employment contracts do nothing to inspire in them an habitual recollection of their dependence on the people. The public patience, subsidized by the prospect of ousting political incumbents, does not apply to Goldman Sachs. As a result, voters, incensed by the failure of elections to jeopardize the veiled authority of behind-the-scenes decision-makers, will be tempted to indulge in middle-finger voting, aimed at expressing their politicophobic contempt for the entire ruling class. Or even, if conditions are ripe, as they were in 2016, at dynamiting the constitutional order itself. In such cases, Western systems begin eerily to resemble those protest vote democracies of Eastern Europe, characterized, according to Ivan Krastev, by high electoral volatility in which governments are never re-elected but economic policies are rarely changed. Voting against incumbents without any hope for improvement under a government formed by their challengers does not necessarily prefigure the imminent breakdown of democracy, but it does represent the incapacity of the electoral system to fulfill one of democracy's central functions. An effortless alternative to protest voting is simply refusing to vote. Indeed, electoral abstentionism and electoral extremism are mutually reinforcing. Tocqueville, whose thinking has inspired much of my analysis so far, helps explain why. In a modern nation such as France, he argued, public opinion will make itself felt in one way or another. If public opinion cannot express itself through political associations, newspapers, and electoral politics, it will be channeled into mob violence. Ballots replace bullets only when elections allow frustrated citizens to vent their anger by tossing out one set of leaders and electing another. Universal suffrage must be seen in this light. The most dangerous political figures are those who claim to speak for the majority. Pretending to act for the nation as a whole, the Jacobins of 1793 to 1794 were able to perpetrate unthinkable atrocities. To avert this danger, according to Tocqueville, it is imperative to construct political institutions that manifestly deflate the pretension of populist demagogues to be incarnations of the popular majority. The only institution that can do this effectively is universal suffrage. Of all the causes that help to moderate the violence of political associations in the United States, the most powerful, perhaps, is universal suffrage. In countries where universal suffrage is allowed, the majority is never in doubt, because no party can reasonably portray itself as the representative of those who did not vote. Associations, therefore, know that they do not represent the majority, and everyone else knows it too. Tocqueville. Where the franchise is severely restricted, extremist politicians and their followers tend to become conspiratorial, aggressive, and swollen with a sense of their own holy mission. Universal suffrage changes all this, Tocqueville argues. When most citizens can vote, revolutionary firebrands forfeit the sacred character that attaches to the struggle of the oppressed against their oppressor. That is how universal suffrage cuts the craziest politicians down to size, diminishing their prestige in the public eye and reducing their capacity to unleash violence on the streets. What makes this intriguing analysis alarming today is its patent inapplicability to a political system where the suffrage is formally universal, but where turnout is persistently low due to a variety of factors, including a widely shared belief that voting does not have any discernible impact on policy. The consequences of low turnout are similar to those of a restricted suffrage. In low turnout democracies, such as the American, populist leaders can claim with superficial plausibility to be the sole legitimate representatives of the one authentic nation. They can even boast about transferring power from Washington, D.C. and giving it back to the people, even though they will obviously do nothing of the sort. Such self-inflating bluster may strike listeners of this volume as preposterous. But when democracy fails to bring voters to the polls, such boasts are not that easy to refute. Eighth, voters who are prevented from voting their interests will be tempted to vote their passions. Political scientists who stew endlessly about the irrationality of the very act of voting should not presume, as they often do, that the voters who end up going to the polls will vote with exquisite rationality. In our time, one of the principal aims of emotional and irrational voting is the desire to freeze demography, or even reverse its secular drift, an obvious impossibility. Demographic anxiety may be the best available explanation not only for the successes of anti-liberal movements and parties in Europe, but also for the raging hostility toward President Obama among the Trump electorate. The essential message of the Obama presidency was that America can be a mixed-race nation and remain America in every important sense. This admirable attempt to reconcile democracy with demography was acutely unwelcome in white nationalist circles. Since America is already a mixed-race nation, rejecting Obama's implicit message was tantamount to endorsing violence, casting another dark shadow over the prospects of American democracy today. Ninth, the weakening of traditional parties in both Europe and the United States and the accompanying shift of public support to anti-system parties or to the leaders of movements, as opposed to parties, also bodes ill for democracy's future. After all, democracy is a system in which parties lose elections. The weakening of the party system, dramatically revealed in the French presidential election of 2017, puts the effective functioning of l'alternance into question. Earlier, if the Républicains disappointed the French electorate, the Parti Socialiste could be elected in its place, and vice versa. But what will happen if Emmanuel Macron, the leader of a middle-of-the-road movement, forced by parliamentary elections to improvise something that resembles a centrist party, ends up deluding the country after his 5-year term? The record low turnout in the June 18th parliamentary election means that large swaths of the French electorate will have minimal or no representation in the new legislature, giving some credence to radicals on the left and right who claim that they represent the true majority. Anger in France continues to mount against both imperious know-it-all EU bureaucracy and poor, especially Muslim, immigrants. If this discontent is not voiced inside the system, the Macron government will be faced with violent and paralyzing protests on the streets. However welcome, his unexpected accession to power reflects a long-term weakening of France's democratic system for processing voter dissatisfaction through a system of rival parties alternating in power. If the political opposition under Macron's presidency consists largely of underrepresented extremist groupings, the next election could potentially bring a virulently anti-liberal, anti-immigrant, pro-Putin, and anti-EU candidate to power. Tenth, the ease with which certain democratically elected governments have used their constitutional authority to bulldoze democratic institutions has further tarnished the idea of accountability to the voters. The most obvious cases are Hungary and Poland, to be discussed shortly. Blocked by the American melting pot from echoing Hungarian and Polish appeals to the ethnic homogeneity of the nation, Trump nevertheless seems hell-bent on emulating East Central European attacks on democracy's core norms and institutions. Thus, democracy is being debased in America, just as it has been sabotaged in Hungary and Poland, by increasing returns to power.